Okay, board members, we are moving into our governance session. It is 20 till 2. We will complete our work hopefully at 20 till 3. And Mr. Barnes, as the new person, ride along with us. Feel free to offer whatever comments you wish. And as I said to Mr. Nichols last time, please read the document and make sure that we get the benefit of any thinking that you have about other sections. The journey we are on is hopefully to finish these last two sections, our robust conversation, the last two sections today, so that at 2 weeks from today, we can, at the board meeting, look at this and say it's a good enough first draft for us to go back to the Riders Advisory Council, the Board of Trade Group, the Tri-State Oversight Commission, and gather their comments, hopefully to finalize in May. There's more work for the Governance Committee to do, but the bylaws are the first piece. So we have two sections which are on our agenda. The first is Article 5, Communication with the Public. This is an article, I'm looking for it. Oh, did we renumbered. I'm sorry. It's now Article 7. And I apologize for that. I worked with staff a little bit, and we reordered some of these sections so that they flowed a little bit better. We put the CEO board relationship and the JCC. Morris, yes.
May we approve the minutes first?
Oh, I forget that every Thank time. Colleagues, could I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Been moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. Thank you.
Can you repeat the who moved and who seconded, please?
Mr. Downey moved and Mr. Acosta seconded. Sorry. Okay. So we are now looking at Article 7, which we do have accompanying procedures, and I would remind everybody of that. So what is here, based on our last conversation, is really just a fairly broad statement about our commitment to communicating with the public. We're open to any suggestions, additions, other thoughts that folks might have on this section. Are there other issues that folks would like to bring up in this context beyond this broad statement? I had identified two that seemed to be hanging out relative to the step and the conversation I had, which is, and this may in fact be long in procedures, but I think it would be helpful to get a little conversation from the board, is whether or not there's any further guidance or clarification that we want to provide about the timing of releasing the board agenda information to the public. The practice, as we all know, is that on Friday when the email comes to us, it is at that same point, except for items pertinent for closed meeting, posted on the public website and available to the whole public. Some other groups, other boards I've been on, there's been a two-day lag in order to give board members a chance to look at documents before the press does it in an effort to allow us time to think about it and not, because sometimes the press is faster than we are. And I think some of those changes, Matt, actually that we talked about before show up in, we've moved those numbers around too. In Article 9 now, Agenda Minutes and Parliamentary Authority, in A, we did indeed add some language saying we were affirming that things would be published in advance, except where it's not possible. But this is silent on how much in advance. And I, again, don't know if the board members have opinions. Ms. Hudgens?
Madam Chairman, you've done such a great job of trying to get us to the point that this document that we're working on now are bylaws and that they are more concrete. And I would be concerned that by putting in guidelines of time that this document may not have a long life, in that we're going to do procedures. Procedures give us a flexibility as other tools come available for communicating our information that we can incorporate them there. It just seems like it would make a lot more sense to.
I'm seeing a lot of head nodding around that topic. Mr. Downey.
Yeah, getting to procedures, I would like to have that time frame to look at this stuff, but I agree, locking it into the bylaws would be, bylaws should simply say we will make it available in advance.
And our statement here.
And define what in advance means in our procedures.
Right. I'm looking up in the app. So let me tell you sort of what's going to happen relative to procedures, just so you're aware. After we do our work today to kind of get the last two sections of this somewhat in shape, at the board meeting, we'll assent to it going out. At the governance committee meeting next in 2 weeks, we'll have a straw man of procedures for you, which is partly why I'm poking at this a little bit, because I'd like to know where your sentiment is so that when we bring you back the procedures, I at least have some language for you to think about relative to this issue. So I appreciate Mr. Downey saying, you know, maybe a day or two would be a good thing. I don't know what others think. I know why the decision was made to go the way it has been. But I think it is really what we wish to have. So you don't have to answer today, but think about it. And perhaps if you have, you know, you end up thinking you'd like us to consider X, Y, or Z, you can send me an email or send Lloyd an email. So we have the benefit of some sense of where people are on that particular topic, okay? And the second issue that we had also identified is also one that is a more of a procedural matter, which is, do people feel pretty comfortable about the system we have for handling calls, letters, other things that we might get as Metro board members, but that come to us personally, not necessarily through the organization? Maybe too soon for our new members to know the answer to that, but it is an issue that has come up in conversation, certainly through our orientation process. This was identified. Mr. Nichols.
Are you specifically referring to media inquiries or just any inquiry that
comes through? Media inquiries is a section of this. I do, in my capacity in Arlington, get emails from riders who live in Arlington. It's any kind of, you know, so just you know what the system is and you're comfortable and you feel supported is kind of what the question is. But perhaps, again, better for a later discussion. Mr. Downey.
I'm certainly supportive of the public having the opportunity to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
I would not want to create an obligation on my part to respond.
In your role, Mr. McKay.
I think Mr. Downey is right. I will say, in my capacity also as an elected official, no letter that comes to my office doesn't go without being responded to, whether it's WMATA or any other. And so I think the difficulty of a uniform measure is that we all report different ways and are here through different mechanisms. And so I think you do want to get away from the obligation part. But some of us are going to be obligated whether it's written or not. And I think you have to recognize the difference as to how people got to this table. And I think you have to allow flexibility for that to be determined by the individual board members.
Mrs. Porter, did you?
I was going to support that. And I think being a former elected official from a very small town, I'm quite accustomed to being offered opinions while I'm out grocery shopping, for example. And so I'm not sure that you can overly formalize this in every case.
I think there's Mr. Nichols.
And I understand that, definitely so. The distinction that I would like to draw is that, in terms of the public and others, I want to, as a board member, I want to vest completely the obligation of management with the management. And I don't want to suggest to customers that there's a different route to the management execution and to the accountability there. And certainly as a board member, I want to understand the system and how it's performing. And I think the forums that are being planned and other opportunities for community engagement are very, very important for us to stay close to the issues from a policy perspective. And I certainly wouldn't tell a customer that they shouldn't write me a letter, but I also want it clear that there's an accountability within the management of the organization to execute, to manage, and we want the customers to feel comfortable that they can communicate directly with management, that we have a process in place for them to reach out and touch the important aspect of management that they want to comment on, and that they'll get a response and an action there. And that's not to say that we should be closed off from the public. I'm not trying to suggest that at all. I just want to make sure that our public knows that we have confidence in management to handle the management issues, and then we have, maybe we have a system that, from what I'm seeing, we get copies of letters that come to management if there's a specific complaint or a concern or an issue. I seem to be getting information on those kinds of things, but those are just my immediate thoughts on it.
I do, if I might offer, I think there is another element of this where customers sometimes pinpoint issues which, you know, you have that person who's the tip of the iceberg, who's thoughtful or has some policy perspective or just has this experience that's a crystallizing experience, who feels more comfortable sending that to a board member in a forward-thinking manner. And so the other piece of the system is that we all know what those things are. And that there is a way that we share that information. Our system currently is very good at sharing the responses. It doesn't necessarily share the incoming. At least that's been my experience. There's some trend kinds of things that we may want to think about as a board, so that, again, in our role as policymakers, forward thinkers, we're getting the best use out of what the public is trying to say to us.
Madam.
Yes, Mr. Manager.
I think what Mr. Nichols said is something very important, and that is that we, the disciplined members, have a role that we should play, and that is that whatever communication comes, we should be communicating only with the executive, not us as individuals regarding the policy role there. But as Ms. Porter indicates, and for those of us who are writers of the system, too often you get a great deal of information, I think Mr. Searles does directly too, so that you want to make sure that in keeping that other role, that you're keeping it such that you share as much as possible and respond to your customers in a way. But I think the piece you emphasize is also that other part in this document that talks about what's my responsibility. Well, I'm not to step over that line, but here we're just simply trying to find a way to make sure the information goes where it should and that the responses go back to the customer in an efficient way. And I think the procedures piece, again, helps us.
I think that's exactly right, and I was going to respond to the concern Mr. Nichols raised too, because when letters come to me, the first thing that happens to them is they go there. They go to management for assistance in a draft response, and frankly, there are things that we get written about that we wouldn't want to get into the details of. For example, I've been approached by people who are going through a procurement process. Obviously, you don't talk to them. You reply and say, received your letter, thank you. So the difference is, I think, the subject matter. But I think it is a good practice for board members, if they're getting inquiries, that those be shared with the management, not only for the purpose of gathering information for a response, but also so that they know what's out there and what's going on. And so that's always been my policy when I get a letter from a writer or a constituent or concerned individual. And I think it's a good practice. And I think it helps us separate what we think is something that we want to opine on versus something that is factually incorrect that needs to be corrected when a letter is sent. And sometimes you'll just get a letter from someone asking for assistance, getting a response from the management. And so I think it's an appropriate thing to do once you receive those, is to send them through that cycle.
Okay. Ms. Porter.
I just wanted to clarify one more thing that I'm hearing, and I think I'm agreeing with what people are saying. Basically, we get two different types of communications. One is, I have a problem, the system isn't working, you know, there's this issue, and I think that clearly needs to go to the general manager and to the staff. But we also get communications that We don't like the option you're considering to do such and such with service, or we disagree with the policy you're discussing, or something like that. And that's that really should come to us, because it's ultimately our decision. And I would like to know what people think about the various policy issues we're considering. That doesn't mean it doesn't go to management, but there needs to be some way. And I have sometimes gone through, and I think maybe we could make a little bit better use of technology, but going through the list of letters that we've received, it's sometimes hard to figure out which ones are new, and maybe we could do something like a pop-up window or something like that, so we could get a sense of them without having to go through the list and say, okay, I read this one before. No, I didn't read this one before, and sort of be able to pull out, you know, them by topic. The topics are very good, but sometimes it's hard to tell from looking at the list whether they're policy-oriented or not. And the policy-oriented ones are the ones I'm primarily interested in.
Okay. Anything else on this section that people want to bring up? If not, then we'll consider this put aside, ready to be part of our strong first draft, and we'll move on to committees. Which has a new number, sorry. It is now Article 12. Last time we talked about this, we were looking at the chart, which had kind of broken things apart, and we had some conversation about overlap, and I have a proposal for you there, but I do want to highlight a couple of issues which are hanging out there relative to how committees work. We have, in the various reports that came to us, there was a request for us to consider taking public comment at committee meetings. And I think particularly as we've worked as a committee of the whole this year, that has people are feeling more and more like the action is here, and when they come 2 weeks later, it's already a done deal because everybody's voted on it to move it forward. So I think we ought to spend a little time figuring out whether there might be whether we could might be permissive on that in the bylaws. So depending on how committees are constituted, it would be possible. It may be possible now as it's written. I want us to have a conversation about. We had a very direct request on that one. The other issue, right now it says all board members may attend and participate in committee meetings, and that's been true for a long time. We've been working as a committee of the whole. It's a lot of meetings. It's a lot of time. I don't know whether we want to put in something that says committees can range in size from 5 members to a committee of the whole, and that would be determined by the board in its annual adoption of procedures, which way, you know, whether you might sort that in a variety of different ways. I think that is also worth deciding a little bit about. Another issue that was raised was whether folks may call in to committee meetings. If you cannot, you know, if you don't have the time to travel here, could committee meetings have a conference call aspect? Could board meetings? I mean, that's in Virginia, we're not allowed to do that. I'll say that right up front, we're not permitted, but I've been on other groups where that was in fact used to great with great success. So those would be the three things: public comment, number of members, and use of telephone technology. Anybody have Ms. Hudgens?
Here we go. Populate the discussion by starting. I've always taken the role of committee meetings as a working process in order to build knowledge and develop a direction or consensus. And while I think the public input is very critical, I think there's a caution of where and how. For example, we have advisory groups, and they play a role there. But the question is that if I raise that, well, secondly, if we're doing our work in helping to communicate with our customers on an ongoing basis about what's going on, does it require the opportunity to have public hearing at the committee level when it's allowed throughout the process and is available upon approval time before the board? And I'm simply trying to think of how do we make the work of the committees as robust as possible in getting work done, but also marrying that in with a clarity of what the communication tool should be for the public in that committee process, so that we don't formulate a recommendation. That is, how often an item comes before us, whether or not there has been enough information in the public venue if we're going to make an approval on an item. And so I think when you're making policy decisions, you need to make sure that you have reached a conclusion of that and that. So I would lean toward saying that I think where the way we have it now, the public has input on the item when it comes to the board, but we provide a lot of information, and we just talked about one way that people communicate with us. They communicate to staff, they communicate to the board members, and that information can be clearly rolled into that.
I guess I have a slightly different perspective, and so let me lay that out there. I sometimes find it difficult on the day that I have to vote, if somebody comes in with some very new perspective or a different take on things, to have enough time to process it and think about whether or not I might want to go in a different direction. So from my point of view, I prefer to get the public comment at the committee level and have a little time to think about it and how I might process it. And I think it is partly a question of I don't want to have public comment repeatedly on an item, you know, six or seven times or three or four times. But I would like to funnel the public comment to the place where I think it's most useful to me as a policymaker. And because I have an inclination to want to explore options, I prefer to know the options sooner rather than later. I don't know that there really isn't a right way or a wrong way on this. I think it is a preference. So I think we do need to hear from a few more people, but I did want to say I find it more helpful to have it earlier rather than later. Mr. Yule.
I have to take off, but I'll just chime in from my many years of experience on three dozen boards and commissions, and we're elected, hired, appointed, whatever, to do the job. I think when you start opening ourselves up at the committee level to having public comment and everything else, it will take away from our being responsible, responsive, and really dealing with the subject matters at hand. I will admit that if there are topics of interest where we really want to have and gain from input from the public, we can always make that known in advance of the committee meeting. That at this particular meeting, we will take public comment on this item or that item. But to have it as part of a routine committee structure, I would be opposed to that.
Okay, great. Anybody else want to add their voice on this, Mr. Barnes?
I would agree with that. Concerns with respect to governance issues that I've heard from people who have been looking at this from the Board of Trade and others is the amount of time that the board already spends and that senior management has to spend. I mean, look at this sitting here. This is they're not doing their jobs running trains and buses. They're sitting here in the governance committee, which I think we really probably only ought to have the general counsel and maybe an expert on governance sitting here with us, not the general manager, would be my view personally. But I would agree with Mr. Yule that that if we feel there's a particular issue that we're going to be bringing up in a committee and we want the public's input, we could arrange for a special opportunity.
Mr. Jones, do you want no? Mr. Nichols is nodding yes.
Mr.
Okay. All right. So is that kind of the consent? We'll at least write it as We'll write some language around that then. Okay.
Was there a part two to that piece in terms of the committee, the whole dialogue?
Mr. Nichols, would you please use your microphone? Thank you.
Sorry. Thank you for learning.
Well, I do think when you're in the committee of the whole,
yes,
and then you vote to send it on to the board, it kind of becomes pro forma at the board table, although not always.
Well, I guess the interplay that was working with me on that is that we've used the term advisedly that we're, during this interim period, we're operating as committee of the whole and for virtually all the committees. And as a discussion point for me, the sense I have is that we have fewer committees of the whole, that we have committees that have specific responsibility for the areas, and that there'd be fewer members but deeper examination. And the challenge for me with all the committees having all the members is that it means that a lot more meetings with a lot less time to go deep into the key issues. And I think that raises the concern within the community. If the whole committee is here and we're discussing the issue, then they've made up their mind. As I think a more traditional or a structure that said that with this 3, 4, 5, 7 or whatever the number is, examine the issue and then bring it back to the full board as a committee of the whole or as a board, I think that might give the community more confidence that we haven't, that we don't have everybody here making a decision, that it's really just those that are in charge of that area that are examining the issue and are going to bring a discussion back to the rest of the board.
Mr. McKay.
I think in concept that's a good idea, but when you apply that to the WMATA structure, that would mean if you're an alternate member, you wouldn't be voting on things ever. And that was one of the reasons why I didn't like the committee structure that we did last year, and why when I came on this board, you know, 3.5 years ago, the structure was committees of the whole, and alternates then got a say and a vote on any topic virtually that was going on to the full board, where at that time, then they can't vote any longer. And so that's what the big challenge is. And I think that the alternates on this board who dedicate a whole lot of time and effort last year never got an opportunity to weigh in or vote on a lot of issues that ultimately came to this board because they chose, some chose not to participate in certain committees that they weren't voting members of. And so I think that is a unique challenge at WMATA that's not typical and I think adds to the complication of this issue considerably.
Ms. Hutchins?
I was going to add something, and this is sort of a different dynamic about looking at this, because we're looking at these as, I think, kind of now standing committees that have a timing and the like. And I know the discussion that we have had, hearing some of the questions asked by newer members, it's the question of whether what are we attempting to accomplish through our committee structure. And Jeff and I can go to the point of we are very much used to a very committee of the whole, because it is truly a work session that the board will participate and make a decision on. And by doing so, the staff's time and the board's time is focused very narrowly on the subject matter and how it is discussed and when it's resolved. And so it does go to what it is that we're really trying to answer here. Size and frequency is going to be dictated by what the item is. And the question is, should it need to be scheduled every 2 weeks when maybe the subject area isn't 2 weeks ready? And the size may need to be the entire board to prepare that for an action. We didn't bring that up in the other part because we have, in the WMATA structure, always had a board member chair, so many members, and you work through it. And the question is, what do you want your committees to do for you? How do you want to populate them with the knowledge to make the decision that you have before you? And how do you move it forward to that decision in an effective way? So I put that on the table to just think about that part as well.
Ms. Barnes, did you, or Ms. Wells? Go ahead, Tom.
come down?
It's not automatic that every committee has to meet every month. This committee this set of committee meetings, because of a lot of press from Finance and Administration about a number of agenda items, agreed we would not have a Customer Service and Operations Committee meeting. It is possible, if you have the flexibility about deciding to not have a committee meeting, to do that. That's part of, I think, having a committee structure that is truly a committee structure. The other is, it strikes me that we have an obligation about committee agendas that we're not really carrying out fully, and that is, we can forecast the business cycle of this authority on most major issues by the cycle of the year. Instead of simply putting out a calendar of committee meetings at the beginning of each year that simply hold dates, as a planning effort with the staff, I think committees ought to try to establish an annual schedule that meets the business needs of the authority going forward, partially because we don't have a business plan, but partially because we get overwhelmed by the events of the day, you know, we have to struggle with this or that. A lot of the, quote, more mundane things, performance monitoring, for instance, on a quarterly basis and in an annual basis as an evaluation at the end of the year about how well the general manager and the staff did in executing that annual business plan and budget. Those things ought to be part of every committee's annual scheduling. It would make it more transparent for the public, I believe, and it would bring some discipline to what is now a random process about where things fit where they fit, and sometimes they don't fit. I think there should be an expectation that each committee is responsible for trying to develop with the general manager a necessary schedule of events or items that the committee will consider during the course of the year, including budget, revenue estimates, safety, security, how all of those things come to the public in a predictable way, and predictable both for us and for the staff.
And that advances the work in a timely manner. We talked about that relative to the budget process. All of this is actually more grist for procedure. I would say even on this issue of agendas, there are probably things which could be consent on committee agendas, or actually just we all agree they bypass committees and go straight on to the board's consent. There's a number of tools like that. I think we do spend time doing things we don't necessarily need to spend time on right now because of past, as we've been talking about. So what I'm hearing is we're not going to say anything about frequency because we really don't need to. We just need to say we have these committees. I don't know whether you want to put in the bylaws a minimum number for a committee. To me, there's some reason to do that, but I don't think it's necessary. The statement we have is all board members may attend and participate in committee meetings. It's very permissive. So I don't think there's an issue there, necessarily.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Ms. Barnes.
Just on that point, I think governance gurus would strongly argue that 16-member committees are not the most efficient and effective way to operate. So I would ask that we leave that question open. I don't have a proposal.
Okay.
But I don't think 16-member committees makes any sense. I think most governance experts, we all go to all these governance conferences, they would say a board should be maximum maybe 10 people, 8 people. Committees should be 5 maybe to be effective and efficient. that's sort of the going wisdom. So I don't know what the answer is here, and I've taken into account Mr. McKay's comments that are important.
The WMATA practice, I think, was a minimum of five, so that you had to have five, and you had to have some jurisdictional split among that to make sure that the perspectives were, I hope I'm saying this properly.
Right.
Yeah. That was only your most recent. Okay.
And I might add that caused quite the problem sometimes with quorums.
Yeah.
So there are other complications as well.
All right, well, I tell you what, let's leave that minimum. No, Ms. Porter?
I finish your thought. I was going to go, if you'll permit me, go back just when you're finished.
Well, no, I was just going to say let's leave that question open. Everybody go consult your governance gurus. Bring back whatever, you know, suggestions you have. We can finalize this in 2 weeks and either leave it as it is or add some qualifying language of some sort. Ms. Porter.
I was just going to add that if we do succeed in moving some things off the committee agendas that the board or the committee doesn't even have to deal with, and if we reduce the number of committee, of the times each committee meets, it might then be possible to consolidate all the meetings into one day per month instead of two. And I don't know what other people's schedules look like, but that would certainly make things easier for me. I would rather than having two half days, I would rather have one full day that I would need to dedicate to doing this.
Ms. Hutchins, that was, I'm looking down at that end of the table. There's, what do you all think down there?
Cheering.
Okay, just a second. Everybody
would love to cheer.
Yes,
I would love to go home.
It would be lovely to do that. I agree. Okay, the last issue here before we get into the meat of the duties of the committees that I do want to check in with people about is this use of the telephone, the conference call, as a way for people to come to attend committee meetings and or to attend board meetings. As I said, in Virginia, they don't allow it. We've asked for it repeatedly and been told we couldn't have it. I do think there is probably some number of limits. You know, you have to limit the number of people who take advantage of it when it's a regular meeting, as opposed to a meeting we call where we all agree to conference, which is a different type of meeting, which is already in the procedure, in the bylaws. So do people want to weigh in on that? Mr. McKay.
I think it's going to be a real challenge for our staff and our board to operate that way. I mean, as much as I'd like to be afforded that convenience, I don't think logistically it probably makes the most sense. I mean, just seeking recognition and being able to weigh in. We have audio problems in the past. The press is there. They want to take comments from people. They're hearing somebody over the phone. I think it overly complicates an already large committee structure that goes through a lot of stuff quickly. The other challenge is, as we know, sometimes the material is updated at the last minute. Some of us get it that day. The people on the phone may not have that information in front of them. I think it just creates some legal logistical problems. There's a reason why we don't do it in Virginia that we all know, and I think the better course is not to do that here unless it's a phone call of the entire board.
Ms. Porter?
I agree with that. But I was just going to say that technology may, before too long, save us from this. Video conferencing is much easier to do than audio conferencing. And I don't know what kinds of facilities there are here to do video conferencing. This is something I could not take advantage of because neither my home workplace nor my other workplaces are set up for that. But that is something that isn't that difficult to do. I've been told that if I simply get a little webcam, I could do it, you know, off a regular desktop computer. But that kind of thing gets rid of some of the problems of audio conferencing. So I agree with Mr. McKay completely on the issue that he brought up, but we may be able to reduce some of those downsides with technology.
Mr. Downs.
I think there's a question for counsel about the legal framework, about particularly at board meetings, what is a legitimate presence having been through this several other times, about legal authority, I think it at least requires an opinion of counsel.
Mr. Huffman, do you have an opinion?
Well, I would say that from many conversations with Ms. O'Keefe, the general counsel, that the view is that the committee structure is permissive. The compact does not address it, and that's probably why, as Mr. McCain was referring to before, the jurisdictional veto, the voting rules don't really apply in the committee structure, because the compact is permissive, is silent on it, and we have always seen it as something that's inherent in the power of any board to establish its procedures to create a manner of going about its business. There is something specific in the compact that says, it's Article 7, the board shall provide for its own organization and procedure. And
the question also, though, was the legal ability of a board member at a board meeting to vote via phone, absent from this dais.
Well, I'm not. We would not view the rules of any of either of the three jurisdictions. For example, we would not view the Virginia rules as applicable to voting here. And again, the compact is silent on it. I have to admit, Mr. Downs, I've not had a specific conversation with Ms. O'Keefe about it, but I believe that her view would be it is for the board to decide, because, precisely because the compact, Article 7, of, Section 7 of the compact is so wide open on the subject. I think there might be some, one issue that certainly comes to mind, I don't know if this is one of the reasons for the Virginia rule, is there might be some issue of authentication. I mean, particularly, you know, when we're talking about a jurisdictional veto, it would be important to authenticate that the person on the phone is who the board believes it is. But I would regard that as a logistical something that the board, if it were going to adopt a procedure for voting, for having meetings by call-in, that would be something the board would need to address. But I don't believe we've had discussions in the general counsel's office about it. I turn to the provision of the compact pretty readily. That's very wide open.
Thank you, Mr. Huffman. I guess I would think at board meetings, we already have our tool, which is we each have an alternate. So I think in a way this is mostly about committee meetings. Where, as Mr. Huffman points out, it's permissive. We could decide we wanted to do it. And perhaps it's more of a procedural matter than it is of a bylaw matter. Mr. Downey.
Isn't it true that the committee meetings are already broadcast?
They are.
Yeah.
They are. Committee meetings are broadcast.
So it couldn't be here. They still could listen in.
They could listen, but
yeah,
they couldn't.
Couldn't participate.
Under our current rules, I think we're really just silent about whether somebody could call in.
Yeah.
And I don't know that we have the mechanism to that. Well, perhaps we think about this a little bit more, too. If people feel strongly one way or the other, I think it would be good to say so now. Mr. Downey.
I have participated in lots of board meetings of both types.
Mm-hmm.
I always find the mixed, some are there, some are on the phone, very difficult. When everybody's on the phone, you understand the process, but it's very hard to get the body language and all of the other things that are going on if somebody's a disembodied voice.
Yeah.
Video conferences are a lot different.
Yeah, that's very different. I agree.
Yeah.
Mr. Nichols?
My bias would be toward people being present, unless we have specific circumstances where we call a meeting that requires participation that might not otherwise be able to be personal. But I do believe that this issue is directly tied to our efficiency as a board. And what I would not want to see us do is to create mechanisms to cope with our inefficiency. I mean, if the reality that we've all experienced is that we have too many meetings that last too long with too many people involved. And what we're trying to do is figure out how we can make that easier. And I would far rather figure out what needs to be talked about, who needs to be there, how long we need to talk, advance the agenda, and create an efficiency that doesn't require us to do workarounds for getting people there because we're so inefficient that we can't figure out how to do it. That would be my bias.
Fair enough. Some combination of Ms. Porter's suggestion of getting to one day a week and figuring out some of these other things. One day a month. Pardon me. One day a month. Okay. Well, thank you for having that conversation. I would like to now kind of direct us to committees themselves.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, no. I'm sorry. I might have been jumping ahead. I thought we were leaving the committee part, and I was just going to raise a concern under C. The second paragraph under C seems to kind of be committee attendance and voting.
Yes.
Seems to kind of be in direct conflict with the conversation that we just had a few minutes ago about public comment at committee meetings. And I noticed that it hasn't been touched, and I'm not sure. That may be the reason why you have heard from some individuals who are upset that they're not being able to publicly comment at committee meetings.
This last line in C is what you're looking at?
Yes. I mean, I realize it's the discretion of the chair, but it has the RAC consultants, staff members, and other parties may be invited to make a presentation or comment on a particular issue specific under the committee.
Right.
So it seems to be that at a minimum, we need to change that to reflect the conversation that we had earlier, and I know some of that's been tabled, but I think I just want to raise awareness that may be why some folks feel like they are not able to comment in committee meetings.
You know, actually, that sentence probably could go over into board meetings, which is Article 8 under public comment, and make it clear that that is available for board meetings, and then perhaps our conversation earlier could. There could be a little squishier sentence here relative to committee meetings.
Yeah, I mean, I think under the board meeting, public comment is a little bit different than what this paragraph says, but I'm just thinking this paragraph is the reason why one might be confused as to why they can't speak at a committee meeting. So I'm not trying to substitute this for public comment at a board meeting. I'm just trying to say that if I read this, I would think, you know, if I contacted the chair ahead of time, and had an issue, a burning issue, I wanted to raise at a committee meeting, I'd be pretty upset if I wasn't given that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I saw some head nods on that. I mean, I think a committee chair could invite these people. It's just that there's not an obligation. I sense there's not an obligation to do so. That's our sentiment of it. So perhaps we can key off of some of what Mr. Yule said previously. Mr. Happen.
Thank you, Ms. Hines. I was actually earlier during the discussion looking at the provision that Mr. McKay drew the board's attention to. I think when we thought about that provision, when we thought about it in juxtaposition with, if you don't mind my drawing your attention to, the public comment provision under board meetings, which is new Section 8E.
On page 8.
On page 8. So when we talked about it internally within the general counsel's office, we juxtaposed the two, that the board was adopting an obligation to have an opportunity for public comment at board meetings, and that's on page 8. But at committee meetings, I actually think it is the language we have there, which is a carryover from the, is that language, as I said, it's a carryover from the current procedures. I think it is consistent with what Mr. Nichols was was urging before as far as it's permissive. If the chair of the committee wishes to, thinks that there's a matter that compels public comment, that it is the discretion of the chair of the committee to make that opportunity available. That is at least, I think, how we understood it when we were drafting it, that we were having a dichotomy between an obligation at the board level and a permissive situation at the decision of the chair at the committee level. So I just want to reaffirm that we did focus on this language and we left it alone because we did not get, at least when we were last thinking about it, we did not think that there was at that point a mandate to change it.
Ms. Porter, I was just going to say I understand how it can be read that way, but I also understand Mr. McKay's point that it looks as if the initiative is on the individuals that want to be recognized. And I'm not trying to rewrite everything, but let me just offer a suggestion that if you turn it around and just say something like, the chair may from time to time invite jurisdictional staff members, consultants, da-da-da-da-da, or other parties to make a presentation or comment on a particular issue, it makes it clear that it's the initiative of the chair and not the initiative of the parties to approach the chair and ask to be included.
Yeah.
We'll make that change.
Mr. Downs. Or you just turned it off.
Suggestion that if we're mentioning the RAC, we should mention the Disability
Advisory
Committee since they now report directly to the board.
Absolutely. Yep. We'll add that. Okay. I do want to just check in with you all about the committee responsibilities. That's the meat of this section. And in consultation with staff, we are proposing a change for your consideration, which would be to move audits and investigations into being a committee as opposed to a subcommittee. And then the merger of two other committees into something that we would call Program Development and Real Estate Committee. They seem to be very closely linked. It's capital programming and real estate development. But I don't know what the board's pleasure is on that, whether that makes sense to you or not. I think audits is a very important part of our function, and to have it be a subcommittee. Mr. Ewell, who had to leave, this particular group, as well as we've had a subcommittee on technology, is that what? Technology review. Those two subcommittees have used closed session due to the sensitive nature of the work that they do. In another section, we reserve closed session or executive meetings for the board. And so we do also have to deal with that issue of may these two committees, if we make audits a committee, who deal in topics that are, in fact, within the purview of what we laid out for closed meeting, is it okay for them to go into closed meeting? So that's one of the last sort of issues sitting here that we haven't talked about. Mr. Down.
Yeah, I think it would be very important from the audit committee standpoint to have that as a standing practice that those meetings would not be open meetings. I also think the audit committee is one where a committee of the whole is a very unwieldy structure that may well call for designating a particular set of members to be the audit committee. Remember, audit committees are working on behalf of the board, just as the other subcommittee chairs are working on behalf of the board.
Mr. Downs, did you have a comment? No. Anybody else?
I have a comment on that. I just want to point out that there are two times that the Inspector General and the external auditors do go before the full, or really the Finance and Administration, and that's to go over the results of the financial statement audit as well as the single audit. And that will continue. Those aren't the things that we would do in the closed right. sessions. Right. And every fifth year when we select new external auditors, that process, some of that is in closed session to give the board members a heads up on the process and if there are any questions. But in the end, it's the board that has to approve the award of the contract to the firm with the best value. And that is also done in an open session. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, one other thing.
Yes.
I noticed that the on page 13, the description of the audits and investigation committee, some of the wording in there is different than the board resolution that created the Office of Inspector General. And the one thing that stood out was this thing about the audit committee will have the oversight responsibilities of the independent accountants, which really is the external auditor. And the board resolution that created our office has it that the IG, the our office, will be responsible for that oversight. And I think that came from the fact that when they created our office, it was modeled after the federal IG. And a federal IG, the audit component, has an oversight over the external auditor. And by that oversight, we have a responsibility to make sure that that external auditor follows the government auditing standards as well as the AICPA, and also our work and our familiarity with the single audit requirements, that that is being carried out. And they wanted us in that supervisory role. So the way this is worded, it has it that the board, the members of the committee will have that responsibility. And I just want to make sure that, you know, it involves us going through their work papers and all. So I want to make sure you, that was, if I read it literally, it comes across that you will be doing that as opposed
to
us.
That was not our intention.
Okay.
I would say we would welcome you editing this so
I
that
would,
it.
I would do that.
Thank you. Mr. Hoppen.
Thank you, Ms. Hines. I wanted to draw your attention to a provision that we added, and it was it followed up a conversation that we had with you by telephone. Mm-hmm. It's on page 11, because we, and it specifically, I think, follows up on Mr. Downey's concerns about that, as a matter of course, the audit committee should be meeting, their meeting should be closed. So if you see sentence that begins four lines from the top, I'm sorry, a sentence that begins six lines from the top. Committee shall not meet in executive session unless authorized by the board's vote in a meeting consistent with Compact Section 8.8 or as provided in the procedures. And as just to refresh, what we, the thinking behind that was there could be, if you will, a standing rule for the audit committee and I suppose for the what are we now calling it, the Real Estate Committee, that those, a standing rule adopted annually in the rules of procedure could address their concerns to need to meet in closed session. And for other committees, it would have to be done by action taken at a board meeting in open session. So that was just to remind that was
Thank you.
we had a discussion about it and Ms. Hines was we were wrestling with this tension between individual meetings and or between a standing process and the need perhaps once in a very rare time for a committee to meet.
Thank you, Mr. Heppen. I had forgotten that we had put that forward as a potential solution to the problem. All right.
So just to clarify, if I'm...
You please do.
I hope I'm not going too far. So in the procedures that we're thinking of, it sounds like we can make provision for the audit committee and the real estate committee to be meeting in executive session.
Right. I think that we could provide for that. And then each year you would take a look at what the work was that was coming. And
right. And the way I'm thinking is that it would give the chair of those committees carte blanche this approval authority in advance to make those decisions.
I have some
concern about that with respect to the real estate committee as it's now being constituted as a planning program development and real estate. I could see a carte blanche on real estate negotiating related issues, but not to hold its planning sessions.
I was not giving them carte blanche that every committee meeting would be. If I wasn't clear, I apologize. I was not assuming that every committee meeting would be closed. What I was thinking we would draft the procedures would be to give the chair of that committee blanket authority to.
That's what I think may be too broad.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Like authority with respect to real estate matters.
Well, as opposed to other matters.
There is a very, if I may just recall, we have a very detailed provision about when the board matters could go into executive, could go into closed session. Just give me a moment, if you will.
It's on page 10.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, ma'am. So it would be, so we could say for the real estate committee, under circumstances that would meet those criteria.
The intention is that you can only go in under these circumstances in an executive session, no matter whether you're meeting in the board or you're meeting in the committee. And I do think that the topic, the agenda, it says in the bottom of page 10 going on to 11, the agenda for each session shall be made available to the public prior to the meeting and shall include the title of each topic to be discussed, reasonably identified without violating confidentiality. So those rules apply whether it's the board or the committee that is using it. So I think we have some pretty careful limits around what can get you into executive session, and it does not remove the obligation to public notice that you are, in fact, meeting in that manner or what the topic is. Am I
think we understand where you're going, and we'll edit it appropriately.
Right. Okay. All right. We're past our time. Anybody have a deep concern about making this shift on the committees? Mr. Nichols.
It's really not a question to open up a dialogue, and it's more I'm just wondering aloud as I'm reading, and on the, for the Safety and Security Committee in particular, for me, it seems awfully specific, and I guess at a point when I fully understand our safety and security plan, it seems like it delves so deeply into the executive function of safety and security management. It's hard for me to distinguish what's a reporting and an oversight versus a direct engagement with the process of security and safety. And it's more of an observation at this point for me. I'm certainly not recommending or suggesting a change, but that's a level that that's an area where it has some concern for me.
Mr. Downey?
Yeah, if I could respond to that. Safety and Security Committee is a fairly new animal. It was specifically created in response to a National Transportation Safety Board recommendation. They felt very strongly there needed to be that focal point for oversight. We met in this room with the members of the board and agreed to do that. They have now signed off on that as having fulfilled their recommendation. I wouldn't want to change it quickly. I think this is a committee that does not have to meet every month. I've had that discussion before. I think we can transition to less frequent, but the issue of safety is of such importance that it really needs a continuing board oversight role, not a management role.
I agree, and it's one of my personally one of my highest priorities. I was just struck by the nature of the language there, and given that context, I certainly agree and understand. One of my particular concerns is to really learn and understand more about our safety, security, and our maintenance programs and how they relate to the safety and security, and learning it, providing the oversight without micromanaging it to the point that it gets it becomes a problem for the executive management. So, yeah, I respect what you're saying in terms of the history and how the design occurred. That was my concern in looking at the language.
Tom? Anyone else? Well, let's go forward with this then. Ms. Barnes, did you have a comment? No?
I'll reserve. Thank you.
Okay. Let's go forward as we are into 2 weeks from now. Please, if when you go home and you think about this, you have other, you know, you have thoughts about editing or anything, just send an email and we'll see. I really would like to get a straw man out, though, 2 weeks from now so that we can begin to finish this up with the public. The objective, that's right. That's right. That as part of our regular board meeting, hold on just a second. As part of our regular board meeting, which will precede the next governance meeting, the objective is to say this is a straw man that we're okay enough with to go back out to the various people who wrote reports about governance and the public in general. At our governance meeting, we will take up a straw man on the procedures, okay, so that you will get a draft of that hopefully in the next go-around. Okay, Ms. Barnes?
Did I just understand you to say that basically the document that you've just been working off of is what we'll take up at the board to go out?
For public comment.
Okay, so if we have some ideas for changes, we should get them to you
As soon as possible.
Before that.
Yes, you should. I'll be talking probably by phone with staff on Thursday next week in order to have something ready to go out in the Friday distribution. Well,
maybe I should mention what I was going to mention earlier and didn't, partly in response to the earlier comments. But apart from my view that maybe we have too many members on committees, I also think maybe we still have, and I know there's been some consolidation already, too many committees, and that there's some potential logical further combination of committees that could be done, could be considered. Finding that list. But I would ask people to, and again, I don't really have a proposal because this is all still new for me, and I may be way off base. But page 12, is that where I'm looking?
Yes, you're at the committee start actually on
yes,
page 13.
Yes, I'm sorry. I had already put this away. It had occurred to me that in this modern age, everybody knows what an audit committee is. Mm-hmm. And everybody knows the importance of an audit committee. And included among the things that an audit committee does is investigations, looking at the finances, the administrative, all those things. That's what an audit committee does. And so it seemed to me that if you had an audit committee, you could combine those two committees and call it the audit committee, because they look at all the financial matters and everything related to that, including investigations and everything else. That's what audit committees do these days. It had also occurred to me, and maybe the comments about the Safety and Security Committee history makes this unwise, but it occurred to me that you could easily fold into one committee the operations. Maybe you call it safety and operations or something like that. It gets into security, it gets into customer service, all those issues, and that those two could be combined into one committee. Those are just thoughts that I had from the view that we still maybe have too many committees, and that these can be combined in a logical way that would allow us to continue as board and committees to look at all the issues we have to look at, but without so many meetings, without so much paper, without so much time of management and staff, maybe we could be more efficient.
Can I ask for
clarification? Sure, Ms. Hudgens, go ahead and ask for clarification.
I just didn't hear. where we have audits and investigations, you were recommending what?
Combining two and three, basically.
Finance and...
Yeah, combining two and three.
Yes, I was proposing that we have an audit committee.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that it have the responsibilities that are delineated in this draft for those two committees, the Finance Administration Committee and the Audit and Investigations Committee, because those are basically the things that an audit committee does in a typical setting.
Mr. Downey, did you want to comment
on
the second?
Yes, I don't think what the audit committee does is the same as what the finance committee does. Finance committee is forward-looking. It's doing budgetary planning. It's talking about resources. The audit committee has a particular responsibility to say, how have we performed financially? And on the safety and operations, they were merged before, and creating a separate safety committee was necessary for getting the safety board to sign off. They felt there was an inherent conflict between having oversight on operations and oversight on safety.
I guess so, Ms. Franz, I really appreciate your, this is partly a function of how the board evolved. I think this summer, as we look at our strategic planning and we look at the way we want to do our work together, it may well be that we'll come back to this and say, you know what, we need a slightly different structure. I think the other part of it is, in my experience in the 3 months I've been here, is that those 2 hours get filled, and it's not extraneous filling, partly because we're all learning at the moment. So I think there's another issue, which is if we can get to some better agreements about how to streamline the topics that need to come into committee that really need full vetting, we may in fact find that we can get to this place that I think you're trying to go, which I certainly agree with. I feel like we're all a little too new, and we don't have the clarity about where we want to go collectively to know what the right way is to organize this work at the moment. So my suggestion would be, let's stick kind of where we are, and we can come back and revise these bylaws after we do the sort of next phase of how we want to work together. So that would be my suggestion. But the points are well taken, I think, by all of us. I think we all agree in one form or another. All right. If there's nothing else, sorry we ran over. Thanks so much.